Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
But it was so hard, and he kept getting up in the morning and taking a step forward, mm-hmm. right? Which is one of the messages I learned writing this book, one of the lessons writing this book about these five astounding people who were made astounding. They weren't born astounding. Yeah. Crisis forged them astounding individuals capable of doing a mighty thing.
Right. It's not surviving in crisis.
No,
forged in crisis. We don't want the freaking crisis
in crisis, because you allow yourself to be made more stronger, more resilient, yes. more courageous, yes. right? More ambitious. Right. All these people accomplish these extraordinary ambitions because they are forged in crisis. So one of the things that's so important as a lesson is sometimes the most important thing you can do is get out of bed the next morning and take the next step. However small, right? History is made by these kind of daily choices. And Lincoln is a great example of this important aspect.
Welcome to The Aggressive Life. You don't have to know much about America to know that probably the most inspirational, if not influential, person in all of American history is, my vote goes to, Abraham Lincoln. So I kind of hit the jackpot when I've been sort of a Lincoln freak, and then I found a new little segment of a book who has been on The Aggressive Life before. Nancy Kane was on our podcast quite some time ago with her book Forged in Crisis. And as you may know about me, I rarely read the books before I'm with the person I'm hanging out with and interviewing. If I like them and I think they got some good stuff, then I'll read the book. And man, she held me pretty spellbound on one another person I found fascinating, Ernest Shackleton. So like, okay, let's dig in the book. Oh my goodness. Amazing, amazing book from this Harvard educator. It's just fantastic. I said, Nancy, please come back on. Let's just talk about Abraham Lincoln. We might do the other three as well. It's pretty great. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about the aggressive life of Abraham Lincoln. Welcome to the aggressive life, Nancy Kane.
Pleasure to be here.
That's really good, Nancy. I've enjoyed every page of your book. I thought it was just great. Is the book gaining momentum, or is it written long enough ago now that it's kind of leveled out, or what's it like?
So the book was briefly a bestseller in 2018 when it came out in paperback. And sales are steady, especially if I'm doing a lot of media. But it's quietly ticking along now here, about 7 years after the paperback version came out.
Well, crisis is something that most people can resonate with, because we've all had our bit of a crisis, right? I mean, I've got a unique crisis going on. Just like you shared last time, you had a crisis that was punctuated by some cancer and stuff. I've got that in my family right now. Lib is dealing with it, and got some other stuff that we're going through. So, you know, crisis is kind of part of the flavor of the day for most of us. And so it's a really sticky title with a lot of good stuff in it. So Nancy, were you always planning on having Abraham Lincoln in the book, or did you get into the idea of Forged in Crisis? You said, oh, I got to have Abraham Lincoln. Or what was the process for him getting the book?
So I was not trained as a Lincoln scholar, as many, many American historians are. I was trained as a European historian. So I knew very little about Abraham Lincoln when I graduated with my PhD many years ago in history. And then in the early noughts, my life just caved in. It just, my husband walked out, my father died, my mother collapsed, I got cancer. It was just a really rough couple of years. And in the early part of all these big life dominoes falling flat, it felt like on top of me, I didn't sleep very well. And one night, this is now probably 21 years ago, I reached onto my bookshelf near my bed and picked up a Modern Library edition of Lincoln's writings. And I just started reading. And the great thing about this particular book was it wasn't just his early speeches through, say, the last speeches he gave before he was assassinated in 1865. In between each writing or letter or speech, there were explanations. There was this wonderful kind of chronology. And the more I read, the more fascinated I became. But the thing that fascinated me most, Brian, and you, this is, of course, partly a function of where I was living emotionally at the time, was how much crisis, how much tragedy he dealt with.
Right.
Not just the tragedy of the Civil War and the, you know, countless deaths and, you know, and you know, if you will, just the huge number of men and women to a much less extent that were suffering in the Civil War, women because they weren't serving on the front lines, but there, God knows there were plenty of female casualties in the Civil War. It wasn't just that. It was throughout his life. It was his mother dying when he was a child, right? And his father leaving him and his sister Sarah to fend for themselves while he went to find a bride, you know, the kids on the frontier. It was, you know, his loss of people that he loved as a young man. And then as a husband and a father, he lost two sons. You know, he and his wife lost two of their four children. There was just so much tragedy. And most of it came out of the blue. It wasn't, you know, a long, slow-burning fuse that he had time to prepare for. I was so fascinated by how he kept on keeping on. And so it was that aspect of Lincoln that I really Velcroed, if you will, onto. And I think that made him such an important piece of that book, Fortune Crisis.
Yeah, when I read it, that section of the book, as I said, I've done a fair amount of reading on Abraham Lincoln, but it really dawned on me, like, this guy really had a horrible life. Like his whole life was tough. He lost like what, 11 elections or something like that. You get to the pinnacle of power, the presidency, and it was just tumultuous and people coming after him and dealing with a war. And we like to think, oh, I'd love to have a life like Abraham Lincoln. What we really mean is, I'd love to be famous.
Yeah.
We don't want what Abraham Lincoln had, which was a hard, difficult life of doing the right thing.
Absolutely. I mean, it was so difficult in the White House at different moments, particularly, I think, in 1862 and 1864, which I maintain were the hardest years of the war for him, the hardest years of the war for a lot of people, particularly for Lincoln sitting in the center of it, if you will, in the mother lode or the ground zero of the war. It was so hard for him that friends, and he didn't have a great number of close associates. Lincoln, I think, partly because he had lost so many people as a young man. I think he held his emotional cards pretty close to his chest. He didn't have a lot of, you know, intimate, shall we say, in terms of people he could talk to and get succor or comfort from. But several of his colleagues, including Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War, were worried about him. They worried that he might take his life. They were worried literally about his emotional fortitude. Now, we don't have evidence that he came close to trying to kill himself, anything like that. We have no evidence that he came close to collapse. Although when people would say, "You look really tired," or "You look awful, Mr. President," he would say, well, as he said to an old friend, "Well, you know, I suppose I must die someday," or "The tired part of me is deep down inside where no one can reach." So it was so hard. You know, I think in so many ways, it would have broken many, many other people. It didn't break him, and history is the better for him. You know, the United States history is, and the world history is profoundly changed by his fortitude. But it was so hard, and he kept getting up in the morning and taking a step forward, mm-hmm. right? Which is one of the messages I learned writing this book, one of the lessons writing this book about these five astounding people who were made astounding. They weren't born astounding. Yeah. Crisis forged them That's into right. astounding individuals capable of doing a mighty thing.
Right. It's not surviving in crisis.
No,
forged in crisis. We don't want the freaking crisis.
In crisis, because you allow yourself to be made more stronger, more resilient, yes. more courageous, yes. right? More ambitious. Right. All these people accomplish these extraordinary ambitions because they are forged in crisis. So one of the things that's so important as a lesson is sometimes the most important thing you can do is get out of bed the next morning and take the next step. However small, right? History is made by these kind of daily choices. And Lincoln is a great example of this important aspect.
Where do you think someone like him gets that from? I always wonder, he was forged in crisis. That made him who he was. But what separates a person like him from the average unmotivated loser who just complains the first time a couple things go wrong and they don't, but he kept going. What is it? Is that a strand of DNA? What is that?
I don't think it's nature. I think it's much more nurture. I don't think leaders are born into greatness. I think they are made into greatness. And they have to make a covenant with themselves that they're willing to do that. Right, they're willing to change. They're willing to grow. They're willing to steel their core muscles and move through the storm. But I think one very important aspect in relation to your question and your general question, why didn't he just sit home and eat cornflakes or whatever, eat corn pudding, and I don't know, watch the deer leap around in the log cabin or whatever. I think one critical differentiator is that he found a worthy mission. So Lincoln's mission for a lot of his young adult life into middle age is largely a political advancement, right? When he's nominated for president on the new Republican Party platform or ticket, he says to a friend, "I frankly confess the taste in brackets for the presidency is in my mouth." So, his and his longtime legal partner, William Herndon, once said Lincoln's ambition was a little engine that knew no rest. So he had this great ambition that I think powered him through the early attempts at politics, the state legislatures involved in the, he was elected to the state legislature a number of times in Illinois, right? Through an attempt to win the Senate seat, two different attempts to win the Senate seat in Illinois, and he loses to Stephen Douglas in this very, very famous second attempt in the 1850s, all the way to the presidency. I think he wants fame. He wants to be admired by people as a politician. But I don't think it's until he gets to the White House, right? When God wants to punish you, he answers your prayers. It's not till he gets to the White House that suddenly, right, the magnitude of what he's inherited and the stakes of what he's responsible for, not just today, but as he said in a speech in 1862, the struggle is not altogether of today, but for a vast future as well. He takes this in. It's a credit to him that he was willing to take in the gravitas and the solemnity of what was at stake. And I think that really powers him, Brian. Yeah. Right? It's like in his moments of wanting to falter, do not flag, do not fail, do not falter. I think there's a real part of him that says, but if I flag or fail, what happens to the mission? First, to save the Union, right? Just keep it together. That's the mission in 1861 at Fort Sumter. That the mission, back to being forged in crisis, expands and deepens in integrity and importance enormously, right? By the end of 1862, when he's issued the Emancipation Proclamation, or he's announced it, he's going to make it law on January 1st, 1863, which is, we're going to be a nation without slavery. We're going to end the pestilence of slavery. And so, again, a man who wanted to be a savvy politician, and that was the end of the story, would never have taken the much bigger step to say, we're going to end slavery and get rid of this cancer on the American experiment for good. Hmm. And so that's a great example of both Lincoln being forged, how he changed, but also I think of then what carried him through some of the hardest parts of the war after the beginning of 1863. I've got to do this. I can't flag, or my God, the country, slavery will remain. The country may be split in two, and this will be awful. So the mission is part of the answer of how he went on.
Brief history lesson for some of us who may have forgot or didn't learn this in school. Emancipation Proclamation, when he proclaimed slaves emancipated, wasn't something that happened before the Civil War that initiated the Civil War. It happened towards the end of the Civil War. And what would you say, Nancy, that some people would say that was just a politically expedient thing for him at that point? He's trying to speed up the war and enlist slaves in the cause to fight. So it really wasn't that big of a deal for him, that it wasn't that high of a moral move, the Emancipation Proclamation.
I think Lincoln is canny, savvy, shrewd person, leader. I mean, as all great leaders are, right? They don't come in just kind of a big box of integrity with a bow of virtue on them. There's a lot of other stuff that goes into leading.
Yes.
And I do think there's political exigency, right? Political canny involved in the Emancipation Proclamation. For one thing, he issues it partly to keep France and England out of the war on the side of the Confederacy, because the Confederates, Jefferson Davis, the head of the Confederate States of America, would love to bring Britain or France into the war to support the Confederate cause, right? Financially, perhaps with goods and other, maybe even with men. But there's a very strong anti-slavery movement in Britain at the time and in France. And once Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation, well, we're done with that possibility. I think a second piece of the pragmatism here.
Hold on. Why are we done with the possibility of England coming in from the Emancipation?
Because because once the war has been declared with the Emancipation Promulgation, the announcement of the Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862, it'll become law January 1st, 1863. But Lincoln announces it.
Yeah.
Announces it in mid-September, I think September 22nd, 1862, after a very bloody Union victory at a place called Antietam, which many of your listeners will recognize that battle, bloody beyond belief, like so many in the Civil War. After Lincoln announces this, the war becomes a war not just to save the Union, but to transform the Union and end slavery, by ending slavery. And Britain, with a very strong abolition movement that's already outlawed the slave trade in like 1809, says, "Oh, we're not climbing into alliance with the southern part of this country that wants to keep slavery alive."
Fascinating. I've never connected that. Nancy,
absolutely.
That's why you're a Harvard-trained person.
And Lincoln knew it. Like, he's brilliant politically, right? He's canny.
Dropping words on me, I don't know.
He's got to end that threat.
That's awesome. Wow. Dropping words on me, I don't know, like exigency.
Yeah,
telling me stuff about Lincoln and history, I don't know. Amazing.
Function of necessity, right?
Fascinating.
So that's a piece of it. The war is proving bloody beyond belief. So just to give your listeners, a tiny piece of this. At the end of the Civil War, the casualties, and deaths, right? It's one number. For both sides, will total over 1.1 million people, okay? Now, here's the kicker. The population of the United States in 1865 is about 34 million people. So if you think of this proportionately, 1 over 34, you end up with a number called 3% of the population of the United States is killed or wounded in the Civil War. Now, that number today would be 9 million people, to put it in perspective.
Well,
so that's how bloody this war is.
And it's like mostly men, like wham, wipe out the men.
Mostly men, and they're just dying by the thousands per day in many of these battles. Jeez. So Lincoln, the Union Army, like the Southern Army, the Confederate Army, needs men. They need manpower. So another important piece, you alluded to it in the question of the Emancipation Proclamation for Lincoln, is we're going to enlist black soldiers. We're going to enlist black soldiers. And this is going to be an important part of the power, the resources that the Union Army has to fight the South. And indeed, it's incredibly important. Here's another really telling fact about this fascinating person and this fascinating and bloody.
Take your time, Nancy. Take your time. Loving every minute. Just tease it out. Go.
So black soldiers, right after January 1st in 1863, black Americans in the North enlist at 20 times the rate of white soldiers, 20 times. Jeez. And almost immediately, Union commanders, now General Grant, whom we all know as the commanding general at the end of the war on the Union side, was not yet in command of major forces. He wasn't yet the head man of the Union Army. But he, like many other Union generals, is incredibly impressed by black soldiers. And this, the reason I'm mentioning this is because Lincoln didn't see, this gets now back finally to the question about, was the Emancipation Proclamation purely pragmatic, or is it, you know, kind of, does it have more of a virtue halo around it? The answer is it's both. What happens as Lincoln gets word of the bravery of black soldiers, this will continue throughout the war, is Lincoln starts rethinking his ideas about black Americans. Hmm. So his own commitment to the Emancipation Proclamation and what after the war, before Lincoln dies, after the war has clearly been won, but before Appomattox, the last major battle of the war in April of 1865, Lincoln will put a huge number of political eggs into what's now known as the 13th Amendment of the Constitution. This is January of 1865. For your listeners that get interested in Lincoln, let me strongly recommend Steven Spielberg's movie from 2012 called simply Lincoln, which is all about the passage of the 13th Amendment. And Lincoln himself, this is back to your question, becomes incredibly involved in working for this. And the part of him that's working for it so hard isn't just the shrewd politician who knows how to gather votes and lobby, right, people. It's the man who has been changed by the Civil War, a man who grew up without any kind of real vision for equality between blacks and whites. He didn't think black Americans were equal to white Americans when he became president. But he was forged into a very new, emerging, and what we would call much more virtuous or progressive view of black Americans and their relationship to white Americans in the crucible of the Civil War. And so the Emancipation Proclamation becomes a doorway for Lincoln to learn more about himself and to become more and more committed to an equal society that was just inconceivable that this would happen before he went through so much of what he went through as president. Another example of the forging.
Yeah, that's a really good discussion point, probably, though I'm taking notes left and right, Nancy, things I want to bring up with you. But yeah, I have a friend of mine who's far more liberal than me. I'll just call it Chris Seelbach. Good guy. And he said, He used to be a Cincinnati city council member. And he said, you know what we call people who grow and develop their beliefs? We call them flip-floppers, because we expect our politicians to believe what they believed initially forever and ever. But that's kind of what you're talking about with, when we shouldn't. We should allow human development, and I'm actually growing and altering my convictions. You're saying that took place with Abraham Lincoln.
It's the opposite of flip-flop.
Yeah, right.
That's God bless your friend, but he's wrong. It's not flip-flopping. It's the growth of an individual, from the inside out, towards a more worthy and virtuous way of being.
Yep.
Right? It has nothing to do with Republican or Democrat or independent. It has to do with what is worthy and good. That transcends all this.
Yeah.
Right? And you don't need to connect it to religion for it to be transcendent, although we certainly can, because all religions come down on the side of this kind of virtue that we're talking about, this kind of goodness. So I mean, the humans, this is a sidebar, and I will be brief, uncharacteristically brief. Every person has a chance to grow into their stronger, better, more luminous side and to embrace goodness in that kind of way, in a new, more resilient, more effective way. You know, we get that chance many times during our life. Some people just keep shutting the door on it. They're the people whose spirit will get much smaller and smaller and smaller after they hit 45. And then other people who see the door, walk through it, they get lighter and stronger and their spirit soars after 45 or 50. Mm-hmm. Lincoln is in that latter category, not because he's trying to get more luminous, but because he realizes what he's been entrusted with and rises through great pain and great difficulty and lots of really ugly days, so to speak, with himself and with the world, into that place.
Yeah. When you mentioned Grant, it took me down a rabbit hole in my own brain for a little bit, and I realized there's a seminal moment in my life that is around this subject matter. As I was digging into Lincoln years ago and led me to digging into Grant, which led me into understanding the vast differences between the first commander, McClellan, and Grant, there was a thing for me where I said, for listeners who may not know, McClellan had all the beauty, all the physical outward appearance, all the pedigree,
all the political connections,
all the everything, yep. This dashing classic hero, and they put him in the battlefield, but he just won't fight. He won't push, he won't press, which was the opposite of Grant. I'm not gonna get into Grant that much, but it was, So that thing related to Grant, who had none of that. I drive by his house all the time where he was born down here in Shiloh, Ohio. I'm gonna stop in that museum someday where he was born.
You should.
I should, I'm a loser. He's one of my heroes. I don't freaking stop in the museum.
He's a really interesting individual.
He is. And it was like God said to me, hey, do you want to be like McClellan who just looks good and has pedigree? Or do you want to be somebody who pushes the fight? Do you want to be somebody who is actually aggressive? That's actually for me, for our listeners, if you're part of the aggressive life, this is the origin story of the aggressive life. This came to me, about two decades ago or so. And you just helped me dust it off, Nancy. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure. I mean, you bring up is really important, and it speaks to, you know, again, Lincoln's growth as president, but also his weakness early on as president. So as many of your listeners, but perhaps not all will know, Lincoln went through a whole like parade, a revolving door of generals, McClellan being who served in a very commanding position, not once, but twice, and was lousy in both instances, right? He couldn't find a general that would prosecute the war as vigorously as Lincoln came to realize pretty early on it would have to be prosecuted.
Yeah.
So one thing to remember is that when the war broke out in April of 1861, everyone on both sides was predicting it would be short and sweet and over by the 4th of July and then over by Christmas. No one anticipated the bloody duration of this war, the difficulty of this war for either side. And so Lincoln goes through a whole bunch of generals. McClellan is a great example. And again, McClellan has all the outward appearances of a winner. And he's very, very condescending toward Lincoln.
Yep.
And it's almost like Lincoln, if you know the history and you're reading it, you just keep saying, you want to say out loud, come on, Mr. Right. President, get rid of this loser.
Right.
As a general, he's a loser. And Lincoln can't do it. He just doesn't have the personal, I think, courage. He just doesn't have what it takes in 1861 and well into 1862 to get rid of this lousy general. A lot depends on who's leading the Union armies, right? The future of the war and the country depend on this. And so it takes him couple of years to begin to look for and recognize the kind of generals. It's not just Grant. Grant's the most important, but there's Grant's old colleague and friend, William Tecumseh Sherman, that will play a major role in the last 2.5 years of the war. And ultimately, there'll be a third really important general named Phil Sheridan. And these three men will just, will just take care of business in the second half. Really, most of the second half of 1864, particularly actually all of 1864, with lots and lots of close calls, because Lee is a very, very good general, Robert E. Lee on the side of the Confederates. They will take care of business. But it will be in 1864, 3 years after the disaster of McClellan, that Lincoln will say things like, you know, when people are anxious about Grant or saying, right, he's not doing enough, Lincoln will say, I can't spare this man. He fights. Or when Grant's detractors complain about Grant's drinking, Grant didn't drink during important campaigns, but he had a history of drinking too much. Mm-hmm. Lincoln would say, tell me what he's drinking. I want to send a case to every other commander in the Union Army.
Right.
So it would take almost 3 years for Lincoln to get to that point. Yes. Of conviction,
right,
that about what he needed and who he needed to command the army. And because of that, because it took so long, it's arguable. I'm not really one for hypotheticals at all. I like to just study what happened. But it's arguable that if Lincoln had seen earlier what he needed and what was available in terms of the Union military, the war could have been ended earlier.
So there's that classic well, for me, it's classic. Some of our listeners may not have heard. I'll just retell a story. I want you to tell me, do I put this story in the category of this is the great character of Abraham Lincoln, or is this in the category of he's a nascent leader at this point and he's not, you know, the way he would be? The story is the one where he goes to confront McClellan face to face, goes down to his quarters.
This is a great story, folks.
Yeah, he goes in, and he's, of course, McClellan's high falutie. He's got all of his pomp and circumstance. He's got a personal servant who's with him, and he goes in the front door, and he's waiting in the parlor. And
he's going to visit, just for your listeners, he's going to visit McClellan to try and urge him to actually use the army. He once said, if General McClellan doesn't want to move the army into battle, can I borrow it for a while and try and get the men to fight? So he goes to visit McClellan in McClellan's home in Washington, D.C. McClellan is not there. And Lincoln is ushered into like the parlor to wait. I think he's also with one of his close personal secretaries. He had two men that had come with him from Illinois, John Nicolay and John Hay.
Yes, that's how we know the story.
And one of them, this is how we know the story, is with him. And they wait and they wait and they wait. And eventually, like an hour and a half in, president waiting, McClellan saunters in, has a word with his servant, who's like, you know, kind of his butler or whatever, and then marches right up the stairs to bed. And the butler or the steward or the ward comes in and says, McClellan can't see you tonight. He's gone to bed.
Unbelievable.
And John Nicolay or John Hay, whichever of his two aide-de-camps is with him, is really, really kind of aggravated by this and kind of working up into a froth walking back to the White House or the Executive Mansion, as it was known, in 1861. And Lincoln says something like, you know, best
day.
Not to be too bothered by these kind of things right now. We have more important things to worry about.
Right.
So even there, like, I'm sure he was insulted, but he had this really good ability to kind of prioritize and brush off small stuff. Don't sweat the small stuff.
You think that's a small thing? That's a pretty big thing.
And not sweating the small stuff.
But that's a big thing. You've got the person who's supposed to be pushing the fight, who you've entrusted all your hopes in, and they're blowing you off. That's a pretty big thing. So I'll ask you again, or maybe there's another category. Is this a part of Abraham Lincoln's character? He's not upset about it. Or is this like me, who my consistent weakness of all the many, many people who've worked for me, a consistent again and again and again, the crisis I avert is releasing people when they should be released. It's just a hard, hard thing. It's a crisis, right? Like if someone does something horrible morally, they screw up sexually or whatever. Okay, that's easy. But like when someone's just nice, but they're not really delivering, that's the hardest thing to do.
It is, but I think this is not Lincoln as a nation leader. I think this is just Lincoln as the human being.
All right.
I mean, so that's an important piece of my book, particularly with respect to Lincoln, but also with respect to Shackleton and maybe with respect to really those two are the best examples. Where I'm trying to rip the individual, the human being out of the marble or outside the, right. you know, the fan, the halo. I want to take him out and take a look at him. He's a person, you know, he's a person who grew and who right. made a lot of mistakes along the way, like all of us, right? He's full of gray matter. But I think this is Lincoln, the human being, right? Doesn't know who else he has as a general to call on if he fires McClellan. So he's not going to have a war with McClellan over the small stuff. I'm sure he's insulted. I'm sure there were many, many days and late evenings because Lincoln didn't sleep very much during the war. Right. He didn't eat much. He lost 30 pounds. Mm. He weighed 155. He was 6'4 when he died. So think about wow. how thin that was.
Wow.
He didn't eat. He used to push his food around and say, you know, I just don't have any interest in my victuals, mm. right? He didn't eat much and he didn't sleep much. So he did a lot of thinking and pacing. He paced. So the 1860s, the White House didn't have a West Wing. That was something that came about after Teddy Roosevelt's presidency in the early 20th century. Mm. So the family quarters were right next door to the office where Lincoln did all his work, hmm. wrote his speeches, held his cabinet meetings, et cetera. And he would just pace the hallways, get out of bed and pace. And I am sure, Brian, that during some of that pacing, he would shake his head and say, damn, I should have fired some of these losers, particularly George McClellan, a lot earlier. He knew.
Yeah.
He was too good an accountant of his own mistakes and his own yeah. you know, weaknesses not to have done the accounting on this one. That's why I say human being makes mistakes. Human being right. resolves not to make the same mistake again, like lots of people who grow. But he knew it. And I think it was much more an aspect of his fallibility as an individual than it was said, than it tells us anything about, you know, any kind of latent or
right.
ready to emerge, you know, kind of out of the eggshell leadership aspect of him.
Well, and to our development conversation earlier, I'm sure he would have handled that same thing different 2 years later. You know, this was very early.
Absolutely.
Man. Man Camp 2025 is just around the corner, October 17th and 19th in Southwest Ohio. Thousands of men from all over the literal world are going to be descending on our property, connecting with each other, having fun, laughing, connecting with God, stretching ourselves, pushing ourselves, playing all sorts of things. It's really going to be phenomenal. And this year, man, we have some new things we're doing this year that I want to make sure that you're in on. First off, Bear Grylls, world-renowned survivalist camper, Bear Grylls is going to be with us. He's going to be great. Dante Bowe, Grammy Award-winning artist. Dante is going to be there with us, helping us out with worship. It is going to be an amazing 3-day experience. Get off the grid. Push yourself. Try something new. Form some bonds. Form some relationships. Have some hangout time. Have some laughter. We get all that and a lot, lot more at Man Camp. I've got a 15% discount off code for you if you enter podcast15 at checkout, podcast15. You can claim your spot right now and do it quickly at mancamp.us and then invite someone to come with you and I'll be looking forward to you there. Let's talk to the aspect of the friends. This is an interesting one because in that book, What's Your Face, Goodwin brought up Team of Rivals. This comes out, but she's talking about his cabinet as a team, not so much as friendships. I hadn't really considered the friendship angle with him before, but as I watched the HBO, did you see the HBO special on the assassination of Lincoln and the chasing after of Mudd and all that stuff? Did you happen to see that a couple of years ago?
I don't know if I saw it, but I know a lot about the assassination of Lincoln, so I know the outlines of this story really well.
Well, what they said in the movie, which I had not read about, that's what I was curious if your opinion on this. They really showed in this, I don't know if it's artistic license or it was history, they really showed a deep respect, if not a deep friendship, a hyper, hyper deep respect between Stanton and Lincoln.
Yeah. And Seward and Lincoln, William Seward, his Secretary of State, right?
Yes.
So Lincoln, let's talk about Lincoln's cabinet for a second. So, and just put aside Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, which is really a group biography of
Doris
people.
Goodwin that. Kearns, Kearns Goodwin?
Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Okay, got it.
That's really a group biography of them, of Lincoln and the men around him. And, yes. You know, that's a very worthy endeavor. Take a look at the cabinet. So when Lincoln becomes president, he emerges at the Republican convention in May of 1864. He doesn't go in as a front runner, but he emerges with the nomination. A couple of the people that he beats or kind of ends up with the nomination who are also seeking the nomination were William Seward and not Edwin Stanton. He doesn't actually appoint. Simon Cameron is the person he appoints initially as Secretary of War. And Cameron turns out to be corrupt and kind of slimy, and he gets rid of Cameron pretty early on and appoints Edwin Stanton. And by the way, Stanton knew Lincoln. They had been not very well. They had been opposing lawyers in a big, big law case that Lincoln litigated in the 1850s. I believe it was for the company that became International Harvester. Huh. And Stanton thought Lincoln, who was not head counsel on that case, I believe they were across the aisle from each other, but it's possible they were on the same team. But Lincoln was not a leading lawyer, and Stanton was. Stanton thought Lincoln was a buffoon. He talked about him in those terms. He says he's a buffoon with long arms and, you know, suits that don't fit. So like Seward, who Lincoln beat out for the Republican nomination, or William Chase of Ohio, who Lincoln beat out and for the nomination and becomes part of the cabinet. Lincoln chooses a cabinet. Now think about what this says about Lincoln. He chooses a cabinet of men he knows are either older or recent rivals of his. That's why Goodwin called the book Team of Rivals. Right. That's not the point of the book. The point of the book is how did the cabinet function and who were these guys? But he chooses people who he knows don't necessarily think very highly of him. So these are not sycophants. They're not acolytes. Right. And I think he chose his cabinet. I say this in my book. I think he chose his cabinet very strategically. Who are the insiders in Washington? Because remember, Lincoln wasn't an insider. He hadn't been in the House of Representatives since 1848. So he didn't have a lot of Washington experience. He's now in the center of Washington. He chooses men that know the system really, really well, right? And if these are people that were rivalrous with him or once wanted to beat him at something, so be it. And he does this in many, many different respects with his cabinet. Seward, a guy named Montgomery Player, who becomes Postmaster General, a whole host of folks that have no love for Lincoln, but know the levers and the pockets of power in the nation's capital. Most of whom come from storied families, not Lincoln's family, right? Off the frontier. So I think it says a great deal about Lincoln's strategic savvy. I need this knowledge. I need the people that are going to help me make decisions to have that knowledge and offer it to me. But then it says something, and this will get us back to friendship, about some kind of deep seedbed of self-faith in Lincoln, that he could not only bring former rivals into a group of men that would become his allies, but he could, in a sense, forge them, forgive my term, overuse of that term, into an effective group. Right, that's going to work together. He didn't know Civil War was coming, but he had hints of it by the time he's choosing his cabinet, because the South was beginning, Confederate states were beginning to succeed. South Carolina had already succeeded, right after he gets elected, et cetera. So I think that's a really important piece, his strategic savvy, his sense of self-faith. And then here we go, Brian. Over the first couple of years of the war, particularly over the first year, not only did this cabinet become an effective functioning group or team of rivals, But a lot of these people come to think very, very highly in a personal way of Abraham Lincoln. Seward gives Lincoln a couple of kittens. And Lincoln, who loves animals, right? Now, he shot a deer. I should remember what animal it was when he was like 8 or 9 years old. His father put a rifle in his hand. He was so seared, scarred by that experience of taking life that he never shot a gun again, shot a rifle again in any game. So he loved animals. So he had these kittens he would carry around. So Seward, Stanton, Chase, Blair, all these different members of his cabinet become what they consider friends of Lincoln. They like him. He tells funny stories. He has an impeccable sense of timing. When he hired Stanton, Stanton had this reputation for being, you know, very, very active. One of the reasons that the war is won on the Union side is because of how Stanton very, very brilliantly administered the War Department. It's called the War Department, not the Defense Department at that time. And Stanton was super active, right? Lincoln is much more phlegmatic. His mind, I think, worked very fast, but he presented himself as, ah, shucks, let me tell you a story. So when he appoints Stanton, he says to a friend of his, one, I think it was someone on the cabinet, maybe a colleague, Lincoln, not clear Lincoln considered all these people friends. He says, yep, you know, Mr. Stanton reminds me of that preacher that was so active and so energetic that his parishioners had to put stones in his pockets, right, to keep him from hopping and jumping up and down, right, at the pulpit. You know, we may have to do that with Stanton, but I reckon we'll let him hop around for a while first. Like this great sense of humor, this ability to detach himself and say something that endears himself to all the people around him. And even though Stanton had called him a buffoon, so Stanton becomes, as you said, implied in your question, one of his greatest admirers. You know, and he's the one who says, I'm pretty sure of this, at his deathbed on April 15th, 1865, now he belongs to the agents. Seward becomes a great admirer, thinks very dearly of Lincoln. It is less clear to me that Lincoln thought so closely of all these people. I think Lincoln kept the world, his wife and his remaining son at home, Tad, Thomas Lincoln. I think he kept those people he was close to. I think he kept the rest of the world, even his old dear friend from Illinois, a guy named Joshua Speed. I think he kept most of these people at arm's length. He just didn't want to risk intimacy unless he absolutely had to.
Yeah. When I think about Lincoln's death, there's a number of ways I've gone with it before, but your book, again, the title, Forged in Crisis, as in we are forged by crisis. Crisis forges us and gets us ahead. And all of us, and Christians, my day job as a pastor, Christians are like, as soon as crisis comes, oh, my God, God must not love me. Oh, no, God must not be real. Oh, what Bible are you reading? Yeah, no. No, it's like you have to be faithful in the midst of crisis, yeah. And it's going to come. Jesus says to worry about tomorrow's troubles. Doesn't say, because it's coming tomorrow. He's implying like, you know, he's saying, hey, because if you're just a nice, good little Christian boy, Christian girl, you're not going to have trouble tomorrow. No, because it's coming, but don't worry about today. Yeah. Let those worry about stuff. So when I think about Lincoln and his troubles and the crisis and the end of his life being taken there in Ford Theater, I before always used to think about the question of what would have happened if he had lived from the standpoint of would we as a country have gotten further along racially if Grant didn't have things mucked up by Andrew Johnson. Could Grant have made for a better transition and kept some of the horribles? I don't know. It's an interesting philosophy question. But here's the one that your book kind of brings to me is we had a battle-tested, forged leader.
Absolutely.
Who was set up for his greatest days of leadership as a result of the crisis. Absolutely. But boom, it just ended immediately. Man, what impact do you think that had on America that— our most qualified and competent leader, at least at that moment, was now out of the pocket.
So I think, there are a few other American presidents or close to being presidents who I think had the same kind of, their untimely deaths had the same kind of impact on the country. it's a profound impact. I mean, let's go to the first part of what you said, just said. He was tested. Yeah. His confidence was high, mm-hmm. right? His sense of purpose was sharp and focused. He intended, as you know, some of your listeners may not know, but he intended a gentle and forgiving peace, right? He said to Grant at Petersburg, which was this terrible battle that Grant was just stuck in through a lot of 1864. He said to Grant, you know, when peace comes, it's got to be a generous peace. I don't care if Jefferson Davis and Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, slip across the country's lines into Mexico or whatever. If they need to escape, that's fine. It's got to be a general peace. We need to bring these people back in as citizens, as Americans, not angry and full of vengeance. So he has this big picture of what's going to come next. And we know, we've been talking about this in different ways this morning, we know he was growing more and more grounded in this idea that we're going to end slavery. We're going to figure out, this is a really important piece that no one ever talks about with Lincoln. We're going to figure out how to make the South, right? How to make the Southern economy and freed slaves, how to bring them into a new life, right? It's not just, the end of slavery changes all kinds of things, right? Most importantly for Black Americans. But on the eve of the Civil War, my friends, literally half of Southern wealth, that's wealth, not income, that's accumulated stock of resources, 60% of Southern wealth is in the form of owning other Americans. Mm. So that's all going to be over now. Mm. So Lincoln is working hard on a transformative plan of Reconstruction. I hate to use that word because we don't know what it means, because no one writes about what Lincoln wanted to do. He wanted to do something very significant, transformative for the country. To bring white Southerners back into the Union, to educate and employ Black, formerly enslaved Black Americans, whom he intended to give the right to vote to, give them the right to vote. Let me come back to that in a second. So he was working hard. He was such a terrible thinker. I mean that in a sense of he couldn't stop thinking, and he'd become a very competent, tried in war strategist. He was hard at work on a very important long range peace program for the country. And we know that he was ready to, this would be the 15th Amendment, dear listeners, he was ready to pass, to work, to lobby for suffrage for Black male Americans, no vote for women yet. And he talked about it at a speech that he gave about a week before he was killed from the White House balcony. John Wilkes Booth was in the audience. And when he heard that, he said some incredibly angry and expletive things about Lincoln and Black Americans. And he said, that's it. I'm not going to kidnap him. I'm going to kill this man. So, and that's something else that a lot of people don't know. But so Lincoln had a big plan, and the country would have been profoundly different and for the better if Lincoln had lived, no question about it. And Grant understood what Lincoln was trying to do, some of it.
Yep.
And he was trying to do some of it, and that ship, right, crashed on the rocks as well in some very real sense. And then under great pressure, this is the last point here, under great pressure, politically, Grant pulled troops out of the South where they were keeping peace all the way through the 1860s after the war and into the early 1870s. And so with the assassination of Lincoln and the corruption of Andrew Johnson and the incredible hatred that has coursed through this country's, if you will, like a river flowed through this country's, you know, rock formations for over now 400 years since the founding of the country, right? The country was in for a set of very, very terrible and lasting aftershocks, not just the terror of lynchings and Jim Crow, but just a digging in on the white supremacist hatred that continues into our own time. So I think it was an absolutely pivotal moment when Lincoln was assassinated for the history of the United States. And we are much the worse for that assassination. It's not the only assassination this country is much the worse for.
Yeah.
But this was the first president to be assassinated in office And the Secret Service was created afterwards as a result of Lincoln's assassination.
So I'm never going to be, our listeners are probably, not to tell you you can't be anything you want to be, but if you want to be president, you're not going to be. So for those of us who are not going to be president of the United States, for those of us who are never going to lead somebody into armed battle, we could look at President Lincoln's life as just really good history and good reading. But that's not your heart behind your message here. What are the transferable principles for those of us in normal day jobs, how we deal with crisis relative to Abraham Lincoln? Like, could you just give us like a little sermonette, like do this, what's the message there?
Well, I think the first thing is it's going to sound a little strange, but it's very, very simple, even though it's going to sound a little strange. When, you know, the calamity strikes, because most of the crises that most of us face is not something we kind of have homing pigeons coming in to tell us about years in advance, right? So when calamity strikes, you have to decide, am I going to be made better, you know, or worse by it? You know, with God as my witness, mm-hmm. right? Will I become bitter and smaller, or will I get bigger and more luminous? That's literally the first thing that I discover that all these people kind of, that's a conversation they have with themselves. See, what no one talks about in the leadership field is that becoming a courageous, effective leader starts with leading yourself. Mm-hmm. It starts with how you lead yourself. And this is the second lesson. So the first lesson is, how am I going to lead myself through a crisis? Am I going this way or am I going this way? Smaller and more brittle and more bitter.
Great word.
The second thing, I'm going to lead myself, and I'm going to, and I want to lead myself right in sync with the values that matter, that really matter. And that's something that's deeper. So this is something I think Lincoln really understands. There's a lot of noise out there, and we're all playing politics in different parts of our life all the time, right? You know, mothers trying to get the family to sit down at the dinner table and have a conversation and get the report card signed and get, you know, deal with the in-laws. There's politics in all parts of our life. And we all have to play it, and we all have to deal with it and sometimes manage it, get through it. But that's, and Lincoln understands that. But the second piece of Lincoln, second offering from Lincoln, the second piece of scripture is, right, learn to ground yourself in the really important stuff. And sometimes you don't get to see the really important stuff until the crisis strikes. So crises aren't just greenhouses for individuals to get stronger and more luminous. They're also like these kind of, they're like big camera lenses that we can focus in on what really matters to who we are. So that's the second thing. That was really something I think that Lincoln understood. Third, this is something that still strikes me as so profound, and yet again, so simple. Lincoln is not a marble figure. He's a human being. He learned a bunch of really important, simple things. When the emotional temperature is high in yourself or in the room, or, you know, a great example is this. Let me just say the rule, the scripture. When the emotional temperature is really high, right, do nothing. The most important something that you can do when the emotional temperature is really high in your life, in your work, in your family, in a medical situation, do nothing at that moment. So, and Lincoln learned this, right? And the best example I can give you, and it really obtains in our life because we're so reactive because of our technology, I think, is right after the Battle of Gettysburg. So the Battle of Gettysburg is fought July 1st through July 3rd, 1863, in this little town in western southern Pennsylvania. At the end of Gettysburg, the Union Army, commanded by a guy named George Meade, wins over the Confederate Army, commanded by Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee's force, everyone's decimated, 55,000 men are killed or wounded of 160,000 in 3 days. Robert E. Lee's army, the Army of Northern Virginia, heads south. George Meade's army rests and starts cleaning up and like caring for wounded. The Army of the Potomac, which is the name of the big Union army that Meade commands, just starts to recuperate. Lincoln finds out about this about a day later that Meade did not attack Lee's retreating army. Lincoln is absolutely apoplectic. You can feel his anger, right, in the letter he writes George Meade. He writes his letter and starts off very flowery, thank you for your victory. And then he builds up a head of steam the way we all do when we're typing an email and we're angry about right. something. We're writing a text and we're starting to use all caps. Yeah. And he builds up because he starts saying, I'm so disappointed in you have prolonged the war, you know, indefinitely. You've cost thousands of lives. And then he folds the letter up and puts it in an envelope. And across the back, he writes, Abraham Lincoln, July 5th, 1863, never signed, never sent. Mm. And it's found in his desk after he died. Mm. Mm. So this is a lesson about doing nothing wow. when you are emotionally supercharged up wow. and you want to react.
Yeah.
Right? It was almost like he wrote the letter, got rid of the steam, and then had the good sense not to do something destructive by sending it. And why would it have been destructive? Because in July of 1863, he didn't have another general in the damn wings. Mm-hmm. He didn't have another good guy to call up. So he couldn't alienate Meade. Mm. So do nothing when the temperature's high. Take a breath, sleep on it, put it in the drafts folder, whatever it is. And I would, let me offer one more, and I don't want to kind of monopolize this, but one more really important lesson. Lincoln understood better than most any president I can think of, maybe better than almost any other leader that we all know that I can think of, the importance of when you're communicating with the people that are going to follow you, you need to frame the stakes. Now, this is a lesson for all of us. What do I mean by framing the stakes? Meaning you need to say, once upon a time, we were there. Now we're here. This is where we came from. This is where we live and what the crisis is. And these are the trade-offs either way of the different paths we might take. So you're laying out what the stakes of the moment are. I say this to every CEO and every major manager that I coach. You want to do a town hall? You got to frame the stakes for your people and your company, right? Here's where our enduring values are, 47 years ago, right? We set forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty, right? That's what the Gettysburg Address is, but that's what all these speeches are. This is where we came from. This is what our founding principle is. This is where we've arrived. This is what we face. We can do this or we can do this. And there are always trade-offs. How do we make a choice that honors the trade-offs that are in sync with who we are and where we came from? Mm. So important.
Yeah, that's good. That's excellent. Nancy, this is... Man, it's great. I'm going to keep having you on. As long as you're going to keep coming, I'm going to keep having you because I find it very, very stimulating, exhilarating, and helpful. One last question for you before we go. You mentioned, I didn't know this about you, that your specialty was European history. So what is the book I get that helps me make sense of Napoleon? Because any book I pick up of Napoleon makes me assumes that I understand French politics and the history, and I get nowhere. Even the movie with what's his face that came out, what is a book on Napoleon that handholds someone like me to help me understand him and that culture?
So it's a great question. And plainly confess, as Lincoln said, I plainly confess, he said this right in late 1864, I had no grand plan for winning the war. I navigated point to point, which of course is what you have to do in a crisis. I plainly confess, I don't know what the best book on Napoleon is. I think the most logical book is probably a book about English and French war in the late 19th and early 20th century, I mean, late 18th and early 20th century, late 1700s and early 1800s. I think that's probably going to steer you the best way because that'll place Napoleon and his ambitions and his military activity or military experience in the context of this ongoing, almost constant war that Britain and France were engaged in, beginning literally in about 1700. It's 125 years of war, punctuated by moments of peace. But the number of years at war add up to about the same number of years at peace. So let me do some thinking, and I'll let you know, Brian.
That'd be great, Nancy. Nancy, is there anything else you want to talk about or anything you want to point our listeners to?
I just would urge people to, when you find a tiny little drop of history or a little segment, a person, an incident, you know, a failure. Failures are really great to follow, that you kind of pick that scab, you dig into it, because the way to feel the great satisfaction that comes from learning a piece of history that you're interested in, the way to do it is to kind of pull on the string when you see something that's interesting, right? And so rather than saying, oh my God, I need to learn all about Lincoln, take one little piece and just kind of follow it. It's really not hard to do now that we have, you know, this incredible library on the internet, and just follow it, because history is really compelling. It has lots and lots of lessons for the present, right? William Faulkner once said, history, you know, the past is not dead, is not even past. Or Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it does rhyme. And so I think we all get a deep sense of satisfaction from discovering those rhymes. But the best way to do it is on your own terms, following your nose about what really interests you.
Yeah, well said. Well, hey, it's called The Aggressive Life because we don't want to just learn new things and philosophize about things when we actually do things, aggressively push things. And man, Nancy, at very minimum, I think has given us all a fuel to do the thing of, at minimum, persevering, at minimum, hanging in there. At minimum, just like stay in the course a little longer, and giving us a really good reminder that it is these crappy times. If you're not in a crappy time, awesome, fantastic. But when you're in a crappy time, this could be the thing that's forging you for a better future. Well done, Nancy Kane. We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and more at briantome.com. My new book, a 60-day devotional called The 5 Marks for Man, 60 Days to a Powerful Life, along with all the other books in the 5 Marks library, are open right now on Amazon. Be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Then send an email to dirt@briantome.com to get a free Aggressive Life sticker. Find more on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.